Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, this is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd on Heritage Radio Network, interviewing in studio Elena Santigade, whose book, The Beginner's Guide to Cheesemaking, has just come out. Welcome, Elena.
Thanks, Diane. Happy to be here.
I'm very happy to have you. Elena was just on recently discussing the Oxford Companion to Cheese, which she was a partial author of.
Contributing writer.
Right, contributing writer.
Much different project.
Right, much different project. Elena, you have packed so many experiences into your cheese life, and writing a book is just one of them. Correct?
That's true. That is true.
Yeah. So are you a writer, or were you a writer, or were you an English major?
Well, I was an English major. Mm. That's the easiest part of that question to answer.
Okay, good.
For anyone who thinks that that English major from a liberal arts college isn't going to get you anywhere, it's not true.
Well, weren't you working in publishing?
I did work in publishing for a few years right out of college, because that seemed like the obvious thing to do with that major. And but I actually was never in the editorial side of things. I was always on the sales side.
Oh, okay. Now, was there a book way back, pre-cheese, that you imagined writing?
No, I mean, I think like so many people who have writing on their radar, I just sort of vaguely thought of myself as a writer through my childhood. I had my parents can attest to the number of empty notebooks with a few words scrawled on the first page, right? You know, the beginning of your great 11-year-old
memoirs.
So,
known as a diary with a lock, hopefully.
A one-page diary. I have many of those. And I did always imagine myself as a writer, but I had no specific project in mind.
You didn't have a work, a masterpiece in mind.
No.
Okay. So how did this book idea come to you? Did you find them or did they find you?
Well, that was sort of the unusual part of the project. So this publisher, Rockridge Press, sort of comes at it from a different angle. And they're, actually based in Berkeley, and they use kind of search data in this digital age to look for project ideas that people want to see, to basically see what people are trying to find out about.
Oh.
And then they decide on projects that they want to pursue. And then they find content people to write the projects.
Oh, so sort of backwards.
Yeah, sort of a backwards, like a roundabout process. And there was actually a very funny connection that I had with somebody at the publisher.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm going to tell you the story.
Okay, good.
Okay, here it comes. Back in my home cheesemaking days, in the height of it, I was really getting deep into it. And at some point, I sent out a little note to everybody I knew saying, I'm looking for small refrigerators. You know, give me your small refrigerator, and I will put cheese in it. So, oddly enough, that was a fruitful call to action because a friend of a friend who worked in the publishing industry had a little wine fridge that they weren't using. And I showed up at his house in Sunset Park, and I picked up the wine fridge and announced that I would be filling it with my bizarre home cheese-making creations. And I think that was a delight to everyone involved.
Why?
I think that it's, you know...
You'd have a storage facility?
Oh, for me, it was a delight because, yes, I wanted this, you know, I wanted to create the prime conditions for cheese aging. And it's just fun to see your belongings take on new life, I think, is how...
So it was a wine... Like, bigger than a college refrigerator?
Actually, smaller.
Smaller?
And I wound up procuring also a college refrigerator that was bigger. And so I used the wine fridge for, at first, bloomy rinded cheeses and then blues to keep them separate.
Could you change the temperatures of both these fridges?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And I originally had a crazy setup because I was going to try to override the thermometer in the college fridge, but I found that... Your run-of-the-mill college fridge actually runs quite warm. And so I was able to achieve optimal cheese aging temperatures.
You didn't have to mess with it.
I didn't have to drill holes in it. No, not in the end.
Okay, so did you have... So you still haven't said how they found you.
That was only the beginning of the story.
Oh, okay.
So a friend of a friend, Brian Hurley, gave me that wine refrigerator, and I went on my way and filled it with cheese. And in the ensuing years, Brian moved to the West Coast and started working for Rockridge Press. And apparently one day... they had an editorial meeting and they had sort of landed on the fact that people seem to be searching for how to make cheese
at home
and how to do home cheese making books. And I guess I sort of imagine that someone said, does anyone know a good writer who knows how to make cheese at home? And so then it came full circle, and Brian reached out to me to see if I'd be interested in the project.
Oh no, I thought you had gotten it from someone else. No, there wasn't someone who was already signed up.
No?
Oh,
that,
okay.
That was,
must be a different book.
That's how it happened.
Okay. Now, how long were your cheese-making years at home, and did it, was it all when you were in publishing?
No, it was actually, I would say I made cheese really actively at home for about three to four years, mostly. And it began when I was in publishing, because I had sort of had time and space, and I was, you know, that's a nice living that you can make in publishing, nice solid living. So I was able to purchase a cheese press and all this equipment. It was really fun. And then I ended up kind of getting crazier. I went another direction and was doing community organizing and advocacy work, and my time got sort of spent on that sort of stuff for a while. But
were you doing that as your job?
I was doing that as my job.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, did you actually make all these recipes?
I will say, so there's 49 recipes for cheese making in the book.
Okay.
And I've made the majority of them over the years that I was intensely doing it. And a lot of them...
So even then, you were making all different kinds and styles and...
Yes, and the harder age stuff and playing around with the blues. And
because I think that's one of the unusual things about your book is that you're not just making fresh cheeses. You are going whole hog and doing everything. And what's for people who haven't seen the book yet, what's amazing is that you recommend that the person reading the book, that their second cheese be a hard tome that they age 3 to 6 months.
It's true. Well, here's what I'll say. That's sort of the way the book is laid out is there are these different tutorials that are very in-depth.
Yes.
And so the second tutorial is for the harder aged cheese.
Yes.
After you do the first tutorial, which is for a softer, much sort of easier to make and quicker turnaround cheese, there are a bunch of recipes for softer cheeses.
Okay.
So I imagine,
so you can, there are people who may skip around.
Right. And I imagine people wouldn't go from fresh chev
to the tome.
Yeah. I mean, that would be a big leap. That would be tricky.
Yes. Yes.
But I do think that it's sort of fun to have... to jump in early on, and even if you don't fully grasp what you're doing yet, to have some of those harder aged cheeses aging out while you're making your way through the shorter,
the quicker
turnaround cheeses, just so you can sort of see what happens over time.
Right, right. Have something in the bank almost.
Yeah, yeah. Otherwise, it's a lot of waiting.
Yes, yes. So when were those days exactly? What years?
So in, let's see, in 2010, 2009, 2010, mm-hmm. 2011, those were big years for me in this intensity. And now that I'm saying those actual years, it did overlap quite a bit with my community activism sort of years when I was doing advocacy
And when
work.
Was, when did you get your first cheese job and what year was that?
So my first cheese job was... You know, it's crazy how recent it really was. It was in the fall of 2011, I believe.
Okay.
I started working at Brooklyn Larder for my friend Sergio Hernandez.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And, you know, Sergio...
Now, how did you meet him?
So, Sergio... I met Sergio as a customer. Uh-huh. I was really... I didn't live too far from Brooklyn Larder, so I would walk over on weekends and taste all the cheese, and I bought a lot of cheese there. I got to know the staff. Mm-hmm. And eventually, when I was making cheese, I would bring my cheeses to Sergio for him to taste.
Oh, excellent. And so did he respect your cheeses?
I think he did. I mean, he even tasted them in front of me, so I know he didn't just spit them out or throw them away, you know? No, Sergio was a great, you know, he was he was really up for it. And he would give me little tasting notes, and we'd talk about how the cheeses were. And eventually, Sergio said... You know, you gotta just, what are you doing? You gotta come work in cheese.
Right.
You seem to be really into this. Which is
true. I know,
true.
Not that many people, I don't think, spend 3 years making cheese at home and then work in cheese. Maybe they'll become a cheesemaker.
Right.
But, or, and true. Move to Vermont or Wisconsin, but they don't usually then go work at a store.
It's true.
It's an unusual path.
Well, it also was, you know, I think of myself as actually very risk averse. Mm-hmm. And so for about, I don't know, 6 to 8 months or so, I worked for Sergio on nights and weekends while I still had my full-time job.
Oh, okay. So you put your toe in.
So I was trying it out because I wasn't sure if cheese retail was going to be the thing for me since I had enjoyed cheese making. But I totally fell for it.
Uh-huh. So then you went full-time at Brooklyn Larder? Or?
No, then I actually went full-time at Beecher's.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I think that's when you first popped up on my radar screen.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah. So anyway, so who joined you? You refer to your friends. Are any of them, are some of those friends in the cheese world now?
My my home cheese making friends that I met in the very beginning? Oh, yes. A lot of people that well, it's a small group, but I'm sure you know Matt Spiegler, the blogger of cheesenotes.com and now cheesemaker up at Jasper Hill Farm.
Right.
And Matt was an early contact of mine, as well as a friend named Yoav Perry.
Who, I know him too.
Sells cheesemaking equipment now and also is very... intense home cheesemaker and makes really interesting cheeses and even ages meats at home as well.
Okay. And did he already have a line on equipment or is that how he got into
cheese
equipment?
Yeah, I think Yoav was, I mean, he might, he would have to correct me, but I think he was already kind of finding cheese making equipment at that time.
And how did you Did you know them already?
Well, so that was two of them. Then also John Bonanno, who had worked actually for Anne at Saxelby at Saxelby Cheese and had worked for some cheesemaker, and Jos Volto of Volto Creamery.
Yes, and, who went on to become a full-time cheesemaker.
Yeah, yeah. So Jos turned pro, I like to say. And so did Matt now. I mean, Matt for a while was making cheese just at home. So we all, I think, I really don't know how we initially connected, but I think I found Yos's blog. I got introduced to a couple people somehow, and then
One thing led to another.
One thing led to another, and the five of us would meet up and taste each other's home cheesemaking creations.
Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't so much make it together as taste it together.
No, we would taste it together. Okay. Yeah, we'd get together, okay. We'd taste each other's cheeses, mm-hmm. kind of talk about what we were doing and trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the two who turned real cheesemaking pro were cut above, you know, especially me, who was the soon-to-be retailer of the group. Their cheeses were a lot higher.
Your cheeses
quality.
Were not good?
No, you know, I'm quick to admit in the book that I am in no way or shape claiming to be an excellent cheesemaker.
Oh, okay.
I think I really, through my own explorations, I really learned how to make cheese.
Right, but learned how hard it is?
Well, definitely learned how hard it is. And then quickly learned that my love for it was more on a
eating.
Retail. It's more in the eating side.
And what percent in the early days of cheeses made were edible? I mean, were they all edible?
Oh, yeah.
But just not that great?
I think most of them were edible. I mean, okay. I had a few. Like, when I would try different categories of cheesemaking, which I kind of point out in the book, when you get to another category and you're trying something completely new, there's mm-hmm. usually, like, one or two key steps that you completely miss.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very easy to do. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes with that, I'd have just a complete failure.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say most of my cheeses were edible. Probably over half were decent, mm-hmm. and some were good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, where did you get your milk? And was it harder then to get good quality fresh milk than it is now?
You know, I hunted around a lot for really good milk. I mean, there is a... people will talk about the raw milk clubs of America in the mm-hmm. States where it's not exactly kosher. And I tried some of that out, but I mostly asked farmers at the farmer's market about their milk. Mm-hmm. And I eventually landed on, I had a couple of favorites, but even something as simple as Ithaca milk, I wound up making a lot of cheese with Ithaca milk,
okay.
which is a local milk source that you could find in like specialty shops in
okay.
New York.
Okay, it's time for us to take a break. This is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd. We're talking to Elena Santigade about her book, The Beginner's Guide to Cheesemaking.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth generation cheesemakers, combining old world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds, delicious fresh cheese curds, or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com, and as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Hi, Diane Stemple here, Cutting the Curd, Heritage Radio Network, talking to Elena Santigade, having a great time discussing how she wrote the book, The Beginner's Guide to Cheesemaking. So, let's see. Next question. Did you go back when writing the book and remake any or all of the cheeses, and didn't you have to use a much... you know, more careful standard recipe-wise to communicate to, you know, in a book?
Good question. Yes, and the answer is yes. I didn't go back and make all of the cheeses that I had made a few years before when I was really intensely doing it, because to my own great relief, I had kept insanely detailed notes.
Oh, on your make
on
sheets.
My make sheets.
Oh, the make sheets come through. Now, just, I can't believe any of our listeners don't know what make sheets are, but could you explain
for the
novice, perhaps?
Yeah, so a make sheet is essentially a sort of a worksheet that contains your cheesemaking recipe. And the thing that I really love about cheesemaking and that I try to convey in the book is that, like any cooking, really, a recipe is just a guideline. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are particular steps and very particular details in cheesemaking, similar to bread baking, I think. Mm-hmm. They're very similar, although don't try to do them in the same room in the same day, because that won't go well. But that's a different show. Anyway, so in a make sheet, you sort of have your plan, and you're also detailing what actually happened.
Right.
So
what, any criticisms or questions.
Right, or weird situations, mm-hmm. like the temperature dropped, mm-hmm. or, you know, you forgot to salt at the planned time, and so mm-hmm. you salted a few hours later. And so it's both a plan and a log.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really the crux of cheesemaking. Any cheesemaker would tell you, you know, the make mm-hmm. sheet is where it's all at.
Right. Well, most cheesemakers make cheese over and over and over again, so exactly. they want to go back and see what made this particular batch
right.
delicious or horrible.
Exactly.
So that's, you're never going to remember all that when you do it every day.
Right. And for those of us who love to just keep track of details and who like journaling and who started those many notebooks earlier in life.
Right.
It's actually
it's
very
a dream
fun.
Come true.
It's a fun endeavor because you can never over notate, I think, when it comes to cheese making. Is the sun out? What's the temperature outside? You know, you can go pretty far.
Right, right. Or what mood, what was the weather? If you're milking cows, what was the weather right. and what mood were the cows in?
What music were you playing as you washed the cheese?
Okay, we can really...
We can get into it.
You
here.
Do speak about Zen in the
yes.
book.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right. The Zen of cheesemaking.
The Zen of cheesemaking.
Okay, now how long... what's your favorite cheese in the book? What's the easiest time-wise and what's the easiest... taste-wise?
Oh, these
is that
are,
too hard?
No, these are good questions. I mean, the easiest time-wise is pretty straightforward, because I'd say that's probably...
The first...
Well, I think that's probably fresh Chev.
Okay.
Which I also just love to have as people's first cheese, because you can learn... Even though it's a simpler make, you can learn a lot from it.
Okay. And where do you get goat milk these days?
You know, goat's milk, I mean, I'm a member of the Park Slope Food Co-op, mm-hmm. which our listeners probably know about, and they actually sell goat's milk nowadays.
Okay.
But there are some producers at the farmer's market that mm-hmm. will sell it.
Okay.
And I actually think that in some of the more mainstream groceries, but, you know, nicer grocery stores, more natural foods oriented, you can find fresh goat's milk.
You're right. You're right. Yeah. But will it be fresh?
Well, that's always the question.
Yeah.
That's why I think you got to go to the farmer's market.
Okay.
And even if you're, you know, the farmer who's selling goat cheeses, fresh goat cheeses, may not have quarts of goat's milk out there obvious for sale, but if you inquire,
right,
you could set up a little deal.
Right, right. Okay, so that's the easiest cheese time-wise.
Right, what was the
What was the easiest cheese taste-wise? Like, just, it's a sure thing.
For me, that was the softer, bloomy rind cheeses.
Mm.
Those came out pretty well for me right off mm-hmm. the bat. I think a lot of home cheesemakers would say that that's sort of a confidence-boosting moment.
Okay.
When you make those cheeses. Because, you know, you have to go through a few more steps with those, and you age them out a little bit, but they're pretty forgiving if you're doing it right and you're, you know, being sanitary and having good practices. You can mm-hmm. make good soft
They're reliable.
Cheese.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
nice. Mm-hmm. That's nice to know. Were there any particular favorites for giving gifts?
I think when I was making cheese consistently, I gave two gifts pretty regularly. One was I would actually make fresh Chev, and I would then make Chev chocolate Chev truffles. with the fresh chèvre that I made. And oddly enough, that recipe is not in the book. But anybody could really do that. If you just mix some, you know, some cocoa powder and sugar with fresh chèvre and roll it in balls and then... and then dip it in more cocoa powder, and there you go. That's the recipe.
Okay.
So that's a fun one. And then the little soft ripened guys I would give, or I'd bring to parties. Okay. You know, I'd make a bunch of them and bring those around, and that was always really fun.
And you were going to parties not with cheesemakers.
Correct.
So they were
especially amazed. They had no idea where my cheeses fell on the spectrum.
Right.
No, they were good. They were good enough to bring around.
And then I think it's really cute that you said you fell into that publishing and I guess maybe community activism didn't have a built-in social life necessarily, and that you found friends behind the cheese counter.
Oh, yeah, big time. I mean, anybody who has worked for me at the retail shops that I've managed sort of knows this sob story and will probably roll their eyes as I say it. But it's really true that I think as a retailer, you never know what kind of a role you're playing in someone's life. And I feel that acutely because of my own experience of really being new to New York as a grown-up. I grew up in the city in my early years, but coming back... after college, I didn't come back with any friends from college. It took people a little bit longer to come to move to New York. And, it takes a few years to really make friends. And so I would just bop around and, like, I was that person at the counter wanting to chat about the cheese. And the funny thing is
I guess I shouldn't be laughing.
I know,
because
Diane, you did the same thing.
I just got on the other side of the counter faster some ways.
I just made the leap.
Oh, I just want to sell cheese.
Whereas I skulked around for a while.
Right,
right. Well, the funny thing is there were a few mongers at that time who, you know, whose counters I would frequent, who then became my distributor, my sales rep. You know, once I really, you know, jumped into the profession. So that was kind of a fun development too.
Yeah, yeah. So let's see. How long did it take to actually write the book?
Oh. Well, I wrote this book pretty quickly.
That's what I thought. Was it in between jobs or?
Part of this project started when I was sort of taking my sabbatical, when I started kind of mapping things out. But a lot of it was written, you know, nights and weekends at an extremely intense sort of, I won't say pace because I never felt rushed, but I did feel like there wasn't a single work shift that I created for myself that I could postpone. And I, at the time,
and
that
did you have a deadline?
I did have a deadline.
Okay.
And that it felt very intense at the time. And I was extremely grateful for the timeline afterwards because I really felt I had no problem completing the book as quickly as I did, especially because it didn't involve a huge amount of research. I mean, this book was mostly
notes
I had already made.
And recipes, and there's not that much going on and on about stuff.
Right. So it was pretty straightforward in that sense, and I just had to plow through and kind of translate my own experiences into this format. And then make cheese and make some of the recipes on the side. But it was an intense time.
Okay. Now, your humorous, encouraging voice comes through over and over, even if it's just like a little sentence in a recipe. And you almost convinced me to make cheese.
Come on. You can do it.
I'd rather do it watching you, though. I'd rather come over to your house and watch you.
Well, you have an open invitation, Diane.
How did you decide the format of the book? Now, did they decide that, the little cheese 101 and ask a pro and the pairings? Did they ask you to do that stuff and you just did it?
You know, most of it did come from the publisher or from conversations we had together, my editor and I. I was actually, this is my first experience working with an editor on a project of some scope. And I delighted in the process of that. I mean, I really felt like...
You liked their help.
I loved their help, and I thought they had such fresh ideas and such interesting perspective. And with those little touches, I think, add up to make the book so much more dynamic than I could have ever imagined.
And I wonder if a long-term author would resent the intrusion more than you did.
Yeah, I think in the sense, because of the fact that they really came to me with the idea, I was very open to, you know, how they kind of envisioned having it play out, and vice versa. I mean, there were a few things that I felt really strongly about doing in this book to both set it apart from other home cheesemaking books and to make sure it was going to be the kind of helpful sort of resource that I wished I had had when I was trying things out. And the publisher was very receptive to those ideas. And the make sheet was actually a big part of that.
The make sheet was your idea, though, I presume.
You know, that was, I was a little nervous because I know that as a publisher, and Rockridge Press publishes a lot of cookbooks, so there's a certain format that a cookbook form, you know, that a food making recipe is normally presented in.
Right.
And I wanted to do something kind of drastically different with the make sheet format. And we reached a really happy medium, I think, in which each category, each style of cheese has its own kind of make sheet template, and then each specific recipe is gone into in more detail.
Well, what I liked that you did, I thought it was an excellent format for teaching or learning, is especially in the first two main templates, you say first, you will do this. Then you say, you will focus on this while you do that. And then you say, here's the recipe.
Yes, exactly.
So it's like, really, by the time you get to the recipe, oh, okay.
You're really doing it.
This is what we're doing. And then we're going to take notes about it also.
Right. Yeah.
So it was very, a lot of steps.
It's true, a lot of steps. And I think that if for the intrepid person who really wants to do this, they're going to, I'm there at their side.
But for lazy me, you almost convinced me. But then, then like, even the goat cheese recipe, you have to wait 8 to 12 hours.
Well, Diane, you're supposed to go to sleep during that time.
I know, but what if you're not home at the right time?
Well, that's what's so important also about the make sheet. In the make sheet template, you have a space at which you actually write down the planned time based on the amount of time needed for each step.
Okay.
And that's huge, because if you're a new cheesemaker trying to figure out how to do this stuff, I mean, I definitely had a few times in my early days where I had...
Did you have to get out of bed?
I screwed up, so I set my alarm for 3:30 in the morning to go flip some cheeses and thought to myself, this is pretty ridiculous. You've missed a step here, yes. Lena.
Yes, because the goat cheese one has draining also. It's
true.
Like... eat what, you know, you'd be dominated. You'll be stuck in your kitchen all weekend.
It's good to do in the winter.
Okay. Let's see. So, I'm wondering where, when you said you taught yourself about cheese by going shopping, what shops were around then besides Brooklyn Larder?
Well, so there was Brooklyn Larder, there Green Grape Provisions,
right?
Which now is a larger shop.
Did you know Sabrina?
You know who I met there at the counter was Glenn Hills, our friend, longtime cheese industry person who now works for an importer,
right?
So I would go there. I would, of course, go to Murray's, but Murray's is so busy and I still had a 9-to-5 Monday through Friday job. So I would go at the busy time. So I didn't really get to know the crew there at that time.
And it had gotten so much bigger, right?
Huge. And those were probably the three that I frequented the most. I also I didn't go to Stinky because I wasn't over in that neighborhood that often.
Okay.
But I mean, I went there a couple times, but it wasn't a regular. And then I also found myself in Artisanal every now and then.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The restaurant.
The restaurant.
Oh, okay.
The counter
talking to
nestled.
Chantal, or was Chantal still there?
I don't know who it was.
Oh,
but it was very, very early on. I had a couple of key moments at Artisanal, nestled in the back of the restaurant at that little counter, tasting, you know, whatever Ralph Beeler cheeses were.
That's
on
where
display.
I first worked for a year and a half.
I know. Imagine if we had met then.
We would have become fast friends.
Of course.
I met Amy then.
I know.
Anyway, okay, so what first inspired you? You talk about the Danish cheese cart. What was on the Danish cheese cart?
I still think about that cheese cart. So for listeners, I mentioned in the very beginning of the book that in publishing I had I scored a big publishing deal that I always felt had nothing to do with my sales prowess, but was because the publisher was so touched by how much I flipped out over this cheese cart at lunch. And I mean, it was...
Oh, you were on a business trip.
I was on a business trip.
Oh, okay.
Selling licensing rights to books.
Oh, okay.
Which is what I did for a little while. And, you know, there was a real Danish Havarti. Which I never would have known was a Havarti. You know, the cheeses weren't marked. This was a pretty sort of rustic cheese cart. Mm-hmm. And there was just tons of different, you know, washed rind, sort of that semi-soft for cheeses that were similar to Havarti, but took it to a whole new level. Mm-hmm. And then also soft triple cream, you know, just local cheeses that mm-hmm. they've just bought from their local cheesemakers. And I was completely bowled over because for me, those flavors... I hadn't had a lot of cheeses that were both sort of had a sour, tangy note, but then were super meaty and a little funky, and there was just so much going on.
Mm.
So that was a great business trip for me.
It's 'cause that is not the country most people think of being that inspiring cheese-wise.
It's true, and I also, that same trip, I was in Copenhagen, and I had another experience where I'd gotten... This is kind of a side story, but I had actually stayed in a cemetery, an ancient cemetery in Copenhagen, way too late and gotten kind of locked in. Because, I mean, if you've ever been to a really, really old cemetery, it's remarkable. In America, nothing's mm-hmm. old. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I got a little distracted, got locked in, started to rain, night falls, had a whole situation.
You by yourself?
By myself, and wound up escaping from this sort of freaky situation and running into a little, you know, little bistro in Copenhagen where they served me a warmed camembert with a local berry jam that also then kind of blew my mind.
And you were saved.
And I was saved by the camembert.
Okay, I just want to tell the listeners one of the sentences that I love in your book. And you might want to explain this sentence. Mm. Thoughtful repetition informs the process.
It's true. It's true. That's great.
Is that cheese making or Zen or both?
I think that's both. I mean, one thing I describe in the book that really got me about cheese making once I started doing it was how much I loved the physical practice of
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you like yoga, make cheese at home. Who knew? I didn't know that. But and it's really that the key is the thoughtful repetition, because you're not just going through the motions, mm-hmm. Especially if you're trying to make better and better cheese.
Mm-hmm.
What you really want to do is be mindful of how you're doing what you're doing and how it might differ from the last time or the next time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Diane.
And discussing The Beginner's Guide to Cheesemaking. Everyone should run out and buy it and make some cheese.
Yeah, make some cheese.
It's Cutting the Curd, Diane Stempel on heritageradionetwork.org, saying goodbye for now.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio.
Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.